Thank you, and welcome everyone to our reporter call on Zika virus. This is Jen Capes of the Kaiser Family Foundation. And with me today, we're very pleased to have Dr. Tom Frieden, the Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Dr. Tony Fauci, the Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH. In addition, I have my colleague, Dr. Josh Michaud here, who will be on hand during our Q&A. And just as a reminder, this is a call for media only. It's similar to other calls we've done on urgent or timely global health topics, particularly ones that are fast moving where information is changing readily. So we hope that this will be of use. As you just heard, this is being recorded and we'll have the recording and the slides will be posted after the event and we'll let you know when that's available. It's a listen only format, but we encourage you to chat or type in your questions for us at any time during the briefing and we'll get to them at the Q&A. So just to get us started, I'm going to show just a couple slides. Again, these will be available. They're sort of more scene setting. And the first one just lays out some key facts. And the one I want to just call your attention to, as most of you I assume know, is the WHO has declared the cluster of Zika-associated cases of microcephaly a public health emergency of international concern. This was done on February 1st. And actually yesterday, the WHO released its strategic response plan. So I encourage you to look at that if you haven't had a chance. 26 countries in the Americas have had local transmission thus far, and 6 have reported an increase in microcephaly or other complications in conjunction with Zika, an association that is not yet proven. Going to the next slide, it's just to show you visually which countries have local transmission. Again, next slide. And importantly, the White House has asked for an emergency funding request of $1.8 billion to address Zika domestically and internationally. We lay out here the components of that request. I'll just highlight that one component at USAID does include the ability or the quest of the ability to reprogram some unspent Ebola funding, but this is not that this request has not yet been acted on by Congress. And then the last slide that I'm going to show is just based on an analysis that we did at Kaiser. I did this with Josh Michaud and Allison Valentine to look at the challenge that this poses for women, given the association with microcephaly and other negative outcomes, and the call by some health authorities that women should delay pregnancy, where in countries where women have limited access to reproductive health services and what challenges that actually means. And we lay out some of the data here, contraceptive prevalence rates being relatively low in some of these countries, and that these countries also tend to have some pretty restrictive abortion laws. So this is just of concern and something that we have more information about on our site. With that, I'm going to quickly turn this over to Dr. Frieden, who will provide some remarks, and then we'll move on to Dr. Fauci. Dr. Frieden?
Thanks very much, and I'll just be very brief. First, the bottom line for people in the continental U.S. remains the same, that the recommendation is that pregnant women not travel to areas where Zika is spreading, and that women who have traveled there and are pregnant see their doctors about being evaluated for a possible Zika infection. We've also provided guidance for pregnant women whose sexual partners have traveled to Zika-affected areas because we do know that Zika can be transmitted sexually, at least for the short period of time when someone is ill, and we'll learn more about that going forward. So first point I wanted to make is that the bottom line pretty much stays the same. The second point I want to make is that we are learning more literally every day. We have about 500 staff at CDC working in the field in Brazil, Colombia, Puerto Rico, Atlanta, and elsewhere. And this is a rapidly changing situation. It is really unprecedented to have a mosquito-borne disease causing a birth defect. And each of the cases that we've seen can be heartbreaking and devastating. And so what we're doing now is making sure that we learn as much as we can as rapidly as we can, that we share that information promptly, and that we take whatever actions we can to reduce the risk to pregnant women in particular. Both epidemiology and laboratory does strongly suggest a link between microcephaly and Zika infection in pregnancy. We don't yet consider that to be a definitive causal link, and there may well be cofactors, either other infections or other factors that could account for why this is occurring. In terms of Guillain-Barré syndrome, we would not be at all surprised if this was related. Guillain-Barré follows many different infections, and including infections that are with viruses similar to Zika, and the pattern of illness following infection is characteristic in the case of Guillain-Barré. So in both cases, we do think a causal link is increasingly likely, but we don't yet have definitive proof on either. That's why we are doing rigorous studies now in Brazil and elsewhere to better understand. As you know, there's been no mosquito-borne transmission in the continental U.S. yet. We do expect that there may be some limited local transmission with warmer weather in the mosquito season. That's based on the previous experience with dengue and chikungunya. The difference in the U.S. Is the territories, Puerto Rico and the other territories. Puerto Rico has had very large outbreaks of chikungunya and dengue, and just to give you a sense, in less than 12 months, nearly one out of four adults in Puerto Rico became infected with the chikungunya virus, which is spread by the same mosquito. And so we think there's the potential for many cases, tens of thousands or even more, of infection with the Zika virus in Puerto Rico, and with about 34,000 births per year, a risk of microcephaly there as well. We currently have more than two dozen CDC employees deployed to Puerto Rico, in addition to our dengue branch, which long-term is based in Puerto Rico and has about 50 staff. And the challenge here is on mosquito control, protection of pregnant women, diagnostic capacity, and establishing the systems to monitor both human health, Guillain-Barré, microcephaly, to do laboratory testing, to do effective communication with the public, engagement of communities, and better understanding of the health risks of Zika. Just for a moment about the tests that are available, we've already developed and distributed a test that can accurately identify whether Zika is present in the blood. We've sent this out to more than a dozen countries around the hemisphere, and with funding previously provided by Congress, we're able to move very quickly to provide those. The bigger challenge is prior infection with Zika. We do have a test that can identify that, but it's not foolproof. It can have false positives. So we definitely need better testing to determine if someone was infected, better methods of mosquito control, and optimization of the methods of mosquito control that we have now. There are some tools that are available, but mosquito control tends to be an area that hasn't been intensively supported in the past and is particularly important. Our recommendations, again, are that all women in all trimesters of pregnancy postpone travel to areas where Zika is spreading widely, and we'll continue to provide information and guidance as we learn more. Obviously, a vaccine would be particularly important, and we're delighted that the NIH is the lead working on this, so I'll turn it over to Tony for a discussion of the vaccine.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Just really quickly, Dr. Friedman is going to have to leave relatively soon, so we'll any questions that come in for you we'll get to as soon as Dr. Fauci is done. So, Dr. Fauci.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here with you. Just going to follow up and continue along the line of what Tom has just described and the role of the NIH and NIAID and other institutes within NIH is obviously in the arena of doing the basic and clinical research, not only to better understand both the natural history and the fundamental basics of the disease itself, particularly the relationship between infection of a pregnant woman and the potential of and reality of congenital abnormalities in the child. I want to just focus my remarks, because I want to be brief, about the major issue that we're addressing that Tom alluded to, and that is the development as quickly and as expeditiously as possible of a safe and effective vaccine for Zika. To remind the listeners that a similar situation decades and decades ago in the United States, when we had the vulnerable childbearing age women in the country with regard to the development of the congenital rubella syndrome in babies born of mothers who were infected during pregnancy with rubella. That situation was as many as 20,000 babies per year born with congenital rubella syndrome, which can be characterized by blindness, deafness, mental retardation, and heart abnormalities. That was essentially taken off the table by the successful development of a rubella vaccine, which was developed for everyone but really targeted women of childbearing age. The situation with regard to a vaccine for Zika, which in fact would be the primary target, would be women of childbearing age, because as we know that as a disease, apart from the possible association, which is likely with a low degree of Guillain-Barré, that this is generally a mild disease, self-limiting with virtually no mortality. And the real issue that's driving all of us is the threat to pregnant women. And in that regard, we have moved quickly in the arena of developing a vaccine, multiple candidates very briefly. We've had experience in the past, which puts us at somewhat of an advantage of successfully developing vaccines for other flaviviruses. The long history of a successful yellow fever vaccine, at least a couple of vaccines for dengue, one already approved by Sanofi in Mexico and in Brazil, and a phase 3 trial which we at NIAID are conducting currently in Brazil that was started in January of 2016. The two prototypes, and there'll be more, but at least two. One is a DNA vaccine, which was used successfully to develop a West Nile virus vaccine. We brought it through phase 1. It was safe and induced a very good immune response. The reason we're able to move quickly, because as being a DNA construct, we had put the original insert of the West Nile viral gene in there, and now we are making it by just substituting the Zika gene in the plasmid, which would then be used ultimately in a phase 1 trial, which we hope to start somewhere by the end of the summer, early fall, I would say end of August, beginning of September, and hopefully get some results about safety and immunogenicity so that we could proceed, depending upon the extent of the outbreak in the beginning of 2017, to move into more advanced trial. So the progress of developing a vaccine, the encouraging news is that we've done this before with similar viruses. Obviously, no vaccine can be made immediately, and it's going to take a considerable amount of time before we have a safe and effective, fully approved vaccine. But we are moving rapidly into clinical trials, and we will keep you updated as to the progress of those trials. So I'll stop there and be happy with Tom to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, thank you both so much. We do have several questions that have come in. One I will direct primarily to Dr. Friedman, but I think it is also for both of you. It's a question from Tom Howell with the Washington Times, who asks about how significant is the fact that Zika is transmitting in Puerto Rico while it grapples with a fiscal crisis? And specifically, will the island be forced, therefore, to seek blood supplies from the mainland U.S., given Zika-related restrictions on donors?
Thank you very much. Maybe I'll start, and if Tony wants to add. Clearly, Puerto Rico has many challenges, and Zika is the most recent. And given the way the ecology of the island is, we do expect there could be a substantial number of Zika infections, and therefore the risk for Zika-associated microcephaly on the island. And of note, our Center for Birth Defects at CDC estimates that a child with birth defects can have a lifetime incremental cost of care of between $1 and $10 million. So in addition to the tragedy that this can represent, the economic costs can be quite high. Puerto Rico has had 80 to 90% of adults infected with the dengue virus. As I mentioned earlier, about 1 in 4 adults infected with the chikungunya virus in the first year of its introduction into the island. So we do have concern that there could be rapid and widespread transmission of Zika, and that's why our focus is on reducing the risk to pregnant women. In terms of the FDA recommendations for blood donations, first off, for the places where Zika is not spreading, we've already recommended that returning travelers defer donation for 28 days, and FDA is releasing guidance on that. And yesterday actually released additional guidance on that. This does have implications for blood in Puerto Rico. We're currently actively working with Puerto Rico, with some of the blood banks there. They already do import a significant proportion of their blood, but not all of it. And we're seeing whether we could rapidly implement screening tests that would allow blood to be screened and then used in Puerto Rico. That's a complex undertaking because it requires both validation of the test and approval by FDA. FDA has been very forward-leaning on this and very supportive. Tony, anything you want to add?
No, very well said. Just to underscore what Tom said, that the general plan of the FDA, and I just got off the phone with them just a little while ago, I mean, obviously working very closely with the CDC to develop a screening test for the blood, but prior to the availability of a widely available screening test, is that in areas like Puerto Rico that really have a significant ongoing problem, is that blood will be imported from areas of the country and regions in which there is no known Zika infection, so that you could at least have a safe supply of blood being brought into an afflicted area.
Right. I just will add one thing. This is Jen Cates to that. As part of the White House's request for emergency funding for Zika, there is a part of that that would be an increase in the federal matching percent that goes to Puerto Rico for Medicaid to provide health for health care costs related to Zika for pregnant women and beyond that. So just to flag that. Okay, another question here is from Jeff Tyson, who's from DevEx, who asks, beyond the White House request for funding, what is the overall state of funding for Zika? I assume this means U.S. specific, but other comments on funding beyond that are welcome.
Sure. I'll start, and I'm sure Tony will want to add. First off, the Zika emergency supplemental request is intended to address three broad areas. One, urgent action in Puerto Rico and the other territories that face the prospect of widespread transmission. Second, support in the U.S., where mosquito control is generally underinvested in and not done in as systematic and rigorous a way throughout the at-risk areas as we would hope. And third, support for international partners to better understand and support the activities in Zika prevention and control. I think a broader issue within the U.S. is funding for mosquito control activities at the state and local level. This is an area that often falls between counties. There are mosquito control districts, and they vary quite widely in their level of expertise and the resources. So this is an area that's that needs further investment, but the supplemental request, the emergency supplemental request, would provide us the resources we need to mount a robust response over the next 1 to 2 years. It doesn't address some of the longer-term issues on investment in newer tools for in the long term for mosquito control and some of the other very basic issues where this type of infection, mosquito-borne illness, arboviral illnesses, are increasingly problematic, and we need to invest in systems to find them through detection, better diagnostics, systems to control them through mosquito control and other rapid response capacity, and to prevent them through better research on both the vaccines as well as vector control issues, which Dr. Fauci can speak about.
Okay, just to add a bit about the question was asked about with regarding to the supplement and funding and how we're, what are we doing until the time we get the funding. We certainly, like the CDC, are very much in need of a request that the president made for supplemental funding. Most of what NIH will be getting in that particular request will be related to the development vaccines, not only for Zika, but also for chikungunya as part of the broad problem that afflicts both South America, particularly Puerto Rico. Right now, we have already started on that. There's a limited amount that we can do with existing resources, which is the reason why we are looking forward to the rapid implementation of that resource that was asked for by the president. So we've started on our vaccine work by moving money that was originally designated for flavivirus. We have a substantial flavivirus portfolio, and we have a number of investigators in the United States and in the South America, particularly in Brazil, who for a very long time, measured in decades, have been working on flaviviruses with us, and we've switched those resources to address the immediate problem of getting the vaccine off the ground, and hopefully when we do get our allocation of the request from the president, we'll be able to accelerate that even more.
Wait, this is perhaps a follow-up to that question, or your answer, which I think you answered this, but Melanie Zanona from CQ Roll Call says, how quickly does Congress need to act on this emergency funding package for before you run out of money, essentially, to in terms of what you're doing and using other allocations to try to respond quickly? What's your timeline for each of you, do you think, on this?
Well, the sooner Congress acts, the better. We're currently in discussions now to figure out what might be able to be done as a bridge, but we're not slowing down any of our activity. As I mentioned, we have now about 500 people working on this response. We're activated at level one, which is the highest level of activation of our emergency operations center. This is only the fourth time we've been activated at that level. This is a big effort. It's an all-hands-on-deck effort for us, but in order to begin really strengthening states and arranging for some of the larger activities that are needed, it will be very important that Congress acts promptly.
Totally agree. The sooner the better.
Okay, we have a question here from Serena Marshall from ABC News, and she wants to know when microcephaly is most likely to show up in an ultrasound, and then related, when it comes to vaccines, how will you handle or deal with vaccinating pregnant women? What's the risk to them with a vaccination at that point, and at what point in pregnancy?
So we're still learning more about this virus. If it acts as other viruses act, the greatest risk will be in the first trimester and early second trimester. We've already seen case reports of women who had a normal ultrasound at 18 to 20 weeks, but then later gave birth to an affected child. So this is an area where we're continuing to learn more and understand more so that we can provide information to women and their families and their clinicians so that they can make the most informed decision possible and be ready for a birth if a child with microcephaly is possibly or likely to be born.
With regard to the vaccine question, as in any vaccine that you use, you always prove safety in non-pregnant people before you get into a pregnant person. That's been the protocols that we've used for virtually every vaccine that we've developed. With regard to the specific candidate vaccines, the one that I mentioned as the one of the two candidates is a DNA vaccine with a Zika insert that when you inject it, virus-like inert particles are made. We don't anticipate any safety issues in a pregnant woman with that. We'll obviously do a phase one in non-pregnant individuals, men and women, and then move on to pregnant women. The situation that you have concern with is a vaccine that's a live attenuated vaccine, particularly if it's a live attenuated Zika, which we suspect is having some neurotropic issues with the fetus. So you want to be very, very careful about ever using a live attenuated vaccine in a pregnant woman, particularly when the microbe in question might have some deleterious effects on the nervous system. So we will go with the live attenuated one first, and that, I think, would not be a problem in pregnant women.
And if I can just add, I 100% agree with what Dr. Fauci says. In addition, some people are wondering, well, if this effect in infants is a result of the reaction to the Zika virus rather than the virus itself, then could a vaccine had the same problem. And I think given the studies that we and others have found that have actually identified the Zika virus in the brain tissue of affected infants, it looks like it's a direct effect rather than an immunologically mediated effect.
Thanks. Another question we have here is from Robert King from the Washington Examiner, who asks, how many cases are in the U.S. now, and will there be heightened restrictions on travel or trade if more cases in the U.S. emerge?
We'll be reporting the cases on a weekly basis. They'll continue to increase. We already have more than a dozen states involved, and we expect, based on experience from chikungunya and dengue, that there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of returning travelers with Zika infection. There are an estimated more than 40 million people who travel to and from Zika-affected areas from the U.S. each year. So our emphasis is, first, that pregnant women should strongly consider not traveling. Second, that everyone who travels should carefully protect themselves against mosquito bites, and there are things that you can do with DEET and long sleeves and permethrin-treated clothing and staying indoors to the extent possible and air-conditioned or at least screened space. For returning travelers, if symptoms develop, it's important to seek care so we can see if an infection is present. And for returning travelers with an infection living in parts of the U.S. where there are mosquitoes that can carry this, protecting yourself against mosquito bites is very important to protect your family from being infected via a mosquito.
One quick follow-up on that from Samantha Caola from the Sacramento Bee, which I think is related, is how far does the mosquitoes themselves migrate? And if they were to be in the U.S., would there be movement from state to state is what she's looking at.
The data we have on where these mosquitoes occur, where they are present, is somewhat incomplete and somewhat out of date. But from what we know, there are maps on our website of where the primary vector, which is Aedes aegypti, is present in the U.S., and where a vector, a mosquito that can spread it less efficiently, the tiger mosquito albopictus, is present as well. And what we've seen generally for diseases spread in the same way is that the mosquitoes that spread it well, aegypti, can spread it explosively with lots of cases in parts of the world where you don't have a lot of screens and air conditioning. But even in areas of the U.S. with these mosquitoes, what we have seen so far with dengue are isolated cases, not large outbreaks. And that's related to the density of population, the density of mosquito populations, as well as human populations, the presence of air conditioning and screens. The primary way this virus is spreading around the world is hitchhiking in people who are sick with it or infected with it. And given the amount of travel there is around the world, that's not something that's likely to change.
Thanks. Here's a question from Tom Murphy of Humanosphere, and I'm going to start, ask Dr. Fauci first. How has the experience with the West African Ebola outbreak influenced the current U.S. and global response to Zika? Is there a risk of an overreaction?
I don't think there is or will be an overreaction to Zika. I think the lesson that the world, if you look at it from a global perspective, learned that you don't ever want to get behind the problem. You really want to get ahead of the problem. And that's the reason why you're seeing such attention being paid and why you have activity that goes from the level of the president himself through our Congress, through the agencies, CDC and NIH, that are involved, and we don't have local transmission in the United States yet. We wouldn't be surprised if we did. We feel we have a responsibility not only to protect our country, but also our neighbors to the south as being part of the global community. We're very much involved in working to help what's going on in South America and the Caribbean. So the lesson of Ebola is don't let something get away from you and get ahead of you. Because in some respects that did happen in West Africa, and we certainly don't want that to happen here in the Western Hemisphere or even anywhere in the world.
I think, and I'll have to go after these comments, that both Ebola and Zika remind us of how important it is to strengthen the systems around the world to find threats when they first emerge, stop them as rapidly as possible, and prevent them wherever possible. It is certainly possible that Zika was causing similar problems before, but nobody noticed because we didn't have the monitoring systems in place. The fact is we have to invest in the systems that can find, stop, and prevent health threats in our own country and around the world. And that includes for mosquito-borne diseases as well as for other health threats, both emerging and re-emerging health threats. We'll only be safe in this country when we have a safer system, a more robust system around the world to find and stop health threats. And in the case of Zika, we have a very different set of challenges than we had with Ebola. With Ebola, we had a very clear sense of what was needed. It was incredibly difficult to do. It required enormous effort, and exactly as Dr. Fauci says, if we had started a lot sooner, it would have been a lot easier with Ebola. Zika is very different. The threat appears currently to be primarily to pregnant women and their pregnancies, as opposed to the threat in Ebola, which was of a very widespread effect, not just through Ebola, but through the healthcare system stresses that Ebola created in Africa. And in Zika, we have a challenge of dealing with this particular mosquito, which really is the cockroach of mosquitoes. It lives indoors in the dark. It's hard to kill. It's sneaky. It can bite multiple people at one blood meal, and we need better tools to stop mosquito-borne illness. And, of course, both of these diseases, Zika and Ebola, are examples of diseases that started in the animal world and then affected the human community, and shows how important it is that we continue to work to get a better handle on the prevention of zoonotic disease and its spread among people. So, Jen, thanks very much for joining. I'm sorry I have to jump off the webinar now.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Frieden. And Dr. Fauci, you have a little bit more time to answer a couple more questions.
Sure. I'm fine. Thanks.
Great. Okay, we have a few questions that have come in about microcephaly specifically, so I'm going to read those. The first is from Sandy Lamott with CNN, and she wants to know about the new numbers about microcephaly out of Brazil, which are beginning to narrow the number of babies with Zika-associated microcephaly. Does that mean that the Zika connection is growing weaker since the virus is not found in all those cases? So that's a question. And her follow-up is some local scientists have, and you, I know you're aware of the study that came out linking microcephaly to a larvicide that was placed in drinking water. Well, that's not proven. What role might it play? And related, Tulip Mazumdar from BBC News says, how soon will we be able to confirm whether there's a causative link between Zika and microcephaly?
Okay, those are three questions that are a little different. They're really related by one common thread. And the common thread is that we will know the direct cause-effect relationship or not with Zika infection of a pregnant woman and microcephaly by doing careful case control studies, which are already being initiated right now in Brazil. That will tell us a number of things. It will tell us whether or not there is a connection and what the magnitude of the connection is. I think if you go down and talk to our colleagues in Brazil, there may be some overestimation to some degree of the numbers of cases, but that does not necessarily mean that there is not still a strong association and a major uptick in microcephaly. The other part of the question is, what about these theories of larvicides being the causal relationship and not Zika? That is a theory that is difficult to disprove at the time. However, you still have to explain the mounting evidence of the association, as Tom mentioned, of demonstrable virus in the brains of stillborns, of miscarried fetuses, demonstration in amniotic fluid and in placenta. So I never rule out anything. I take all theories seriously, but there's no evidence that strongly suggests that that theory about larvicide is in fact a theory that is based on reality. But as I mentioned, we will find out the answer to all of the questions that the questioner asked by doing the case-controlled studies. And they will likely, the third question was, how long would it take? It probably would wind up taking several months to do a good case-controlled study, at least several months.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful. Thank you. We have a question as well from Donna Young. I'm looking for the news outlet. Question is, how many pharmaceutical companies are now engaged? Oh, she's from Scripps Intelligence. How many pharmaceutical companies are now engaged with you at NIH on discussions about the Zika vaccine and R&D related to it?
Well, literally, as the days and weeks go by, we get more and more companies that are expressing to us an interest in partnering with us, particularly in the development of vaccines in the advanced development stage. I can't give you exactly the number, but I can tell you that I have been dealing with directly at least three major companies, and there likely will be more.
Great, thanks. And so we just to let all of you who are in listen mode and sending in questions, we have one more question that I'm going to ask. So if you have any others, send them in now. Here's another question from Jeff Tyson of DevEx. And I think, Dr. Fauci, you started to talk about this earlier. What lessons, funding or otherwise, can global health professionals take from other mosquito-borne tropical diseases and apply them to Zika?
Well, I think there are some important lessons because we have a situation here with Zika in which you have a flavivirus, which is the same class of virus of other infections that have been in the Western Hemisphere, namely dengue, the history of yellow fever, West Nile throughout the United States, the mosquito that transmits Zika and dengue and yellow fever are all the same mosquito, the Aedes aegypti. So you can generally get a good idea of how this particular virus likely will act. Explosion in Brazil was probably due to a couple of confluent factors. One is the relative immunological naivete of the population, never having been exposed to Zika before, but also the extraordinary burden of mosquitoes that we are seeing in Brazil, particularly in the northeast, where that's the hardest hit section. So the lessons learned are we've dealt with these class of viruses before, and we have had some success in the development of vaccines. So I think that that's going to be the roadmap of hopefully a successful countermeasure approach to Zika.
Thanks. I think I have our last question from John Greenberg at PolitiFact, who says, I'm going to read what he says, not to drag down the discussion, but is there any evidence that the Tdap vaccine used in Brazil was any different from the version used in the U.S. and Europe? And he says that this is a question they've been getting. We would welcome your input on that.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it. The what vaccine?
Tdap. If the Tdap vaccine that was used in Brazil was any different from the version we have here in the U.S. or Europe.
I don't think there is. I don't have any specific knowledge of any differences in those vaccines that used here and used in Brazil.
Okay. All right. That was actually our last question. Oh, wait. Two more just came in. See, when you always are about to cut people off, you get questions. So we'll take a couple more, and then we're going to end the call. I'm just waiting for those to come to me. Here's one. Yesterday, this is from Alicia Alt from Medscape. Yesterday at an IOM forum, an NIH staffer said it would take 4 years to bring the vaccine to market. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I don't know why he said that, but I think that, that has to be put into context, and that's why people get confused. A vaccine that comes to market that has the full approval with safety and efficacy, all the I's dotted and the T's crossed from the FDA or a related regulatory authorities, it is true. It likely will take a few years. That could be 3 to 5 or more years before it is in a vial, in a pharmacy, ready to be dispensed. That's different from the development of a vaccine under an emergency situation, which I described in answer to a previous question. And let me very briefly go over that. There's no doubt that unless something happens that we don't predict, that we'll be able to have a vaccine in a phase 1 study by the end of the summer, early fall, let's say September. It takes about 3 months or 4 months to do a phase one trial. That means by the end of the 2016, early 2017, we will know the candidate is safe and induces a good immune response. If there are no more infections, if the epidemic dies down, you may take several years to prove that it works because you need a certain number of infections that you prevent to determine if it works. However, and I hope this isn't the case, but if in the beginning of 2017 we still have a raging epidemic in South America and the Caribbean, you may be able to prove within a 6 to 8 month period, let's say 8 months, that the vaccine actually does work. Now you're getting towards the end of 2017. If you've then shown that it's effective, you may not get official approval with all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, but it is conceivable that you can get an emergency accelerated approval of the vaccine within far less time than 5 years. So that's the reason why the statement that was made at the IOM is true, but I don't think it took into account what could happen if you were in an emergency situation.
Great, thanks. Okay, this is the last question because after this we're gonna end the webinar. The last question is from Tulip Mozumdar from BBC News. Do you think the most likely outcome here is that people will develop their own immunity before a vaccine becomes available?
Well, the people who get infected would certainly develop their own immunity, but what about the people who didn't get infected? That's the reason why you want a vaccine. So if the question is, do you think that people will continue to be developing immunity because getting infected? Of course. But there have been estimated only 1.5 to 2 million infections of Zika in Brazil right now, which means that there are millions and millions and millions of people who've not been affected and have not been infected. And those are the people that you want to protect with the vaccine.
Okay. Thank you so much. I would like to actually bring this to a close. I think we had a couple more questions come in. I would just encourage anyone who did not have a question answered to communicate with our associate here, Katie Smith. We'll make sure to get some answers to you, and you can find additional resources at our site, kff.org. So a lot of the information that you heard today will be shared. I really want to just first thank Dr. Fauci and Dr. Frieden for taking the time to be here with us and answer these questions. We know how important it is to reporters who are also trying to follow this information. We really appreciate your time. And thanks to everyone who joined today. Again, we appreciate you sending in questions, and if we didn't get to you, we're happy to follow up. Thanks again. This is Jen Cates, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. Be with you.